From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a look back at the year's best pop music and films. Rock critic Ken Tucker plays us records from his 10 best list, and film critic Stephen Schiff reveals his picks for the 10 best movies of the year, and he examines the directions the movie industry headed in. Also, Maureen Carrigan reflects on the end of the so-called Year of the Woman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush has formally accepted the terms of a strategic arms reduction treaty between the United States and Russia and will meet with Russian President Boris Yeltsin this weekend to sign it. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The main terms of the treaty were finalized in Geneva yesterday, and President Bush wasted no time in announcing his approval. He met with reporters in the Rose Garden this morning.
This historic treaty will reduce by two-thirds current nuclear arsenals and will dramatically lower the numbers of strategic nuclear arms permitted by START 1. In my view, this treaty is good for all mankind.
President Bush will fly to Sochi, Russia to sign the treaty after visiting with American troops and relief workers in Somalia. START 2 must still be ratified by the U.S. Senate and the Russian legislature. Conservatives in Moscow promised to oppose ratification, saying the treaty is disadvantageous to Russia because it eliminates land-based multiple warhead missiles, the country's most powerful weapon. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Iraqi warplanes have reportedly continued to challenge the Allied no-fly zone in southern Iraq, despite the fact that one of their number was shot down on Sunday by U.S. fighters. The Reuters news agency quoted a U.S. defense official as saying that the Iraqi planes have followed a pattern of flying close to the zone, sometimes so close that it's hard to tell if they're violating it. The official, who spoke on condition of anonymity, said the Allies are determined to enforce the no-fly zone. After being banned from holding public office for 8 years following his resignation yesterday as president of Brazil, Fernando Collor lashed out today at the impeachment process that forced him out of office. NPR's David Wellner reports from Rio de Janeiro.
Collor said the Senate's verdict this morning finding him guilty of corruption was a violation of the Constitution. He added that the entire impeachment process against him was nothing more than a farce perpetrated by elites trying to obstruct the modernization of Brazil. Collor said he had no other choice but to resign once he realized his trial in the Senate yesterday would be nothing more than what he called a summary execution. The 43-year-old former leader said he would appeal to Brazil's Supreme Court to overturn the Senate's ban on political activity. He stated he had no intention of leaving the country, nor of abandoning the humble and dispossessed. Collor's remarks were nationally broadcast shortly after former Vice President Itamar Franco, who was sworn in yesterday as president, accused Collor in a televised address of impoverishing Brazil. I'm David Wellner in Rio de Janeiro.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. Analysts said that traders were responding to reports of a strong holiday season for retail merchants. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 10 points to close at 3,321. Advances led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR. United Nations envoy James Jonah left Israel today after apparently failing to resolve the plight of more than 400 Palestinians stranded in a no-man's land in Lebanon. Jonah attempted to get Israel and Lebanon to agree to a plan to provide supplies to the exiles, who were expelled by Israel for alleged Muslim fundamentalist activities. Lebanon refused, saying the exiles are Israel's responsibility. Jonah also relayed a proposal from Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali that the exiles be placed in Israeli internment camps until their cases are resolved. A long-running investigation of two government AIDS researchers has ended in a verdict of scientific misconduct. NPR's Joe Palka has a report.
The investigation focused on Robert Gallo and Mika Popovich, two scientists who isolated the AIDS virus in 1983. Questions arose about whether Gallo and Popovich used a virus discovered by French researchers and then tried to claim it as their own discovery. Now, after 3 years, government investigators have decided they can't resolve the theft issue, but they have determined it was unlikely that Gallo and Popovich stole the French virus because they clearly had viral samples of their own. The investigation did find both scientists guilty of misconduct for minor misstatements in a 1984 paper that described their research. As punishment, the investigators recommended that Gallo and Popovich be closely supervised for 3 years. Gallo says he'll definitely appeal the misconduct findings. Popovich is considering an appeal. I'm Joe Palka in Washington.
The government's index of leading economic indicators posted a healthy gain in November, suggesting that the U.S. economy will continue to grow over the next 6 to 9 months. The Commerce Department said that the index grew by 0.8% last month, the largest increase since last January. The index is a composite of 11 economic statistics. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We couldn't let 1992 end without asking our rock critic Ken Tucker to play his picks for the 10 best records of the year. If you don't have time to keep up with pop music, this will give you a chance to catch up on what you've missed. Let's get started with something from Arrested Development's debut album. This is People Every Day.
I told the niggas, please, let us pass, friend. I said please, cause I don't like killing Africans. But he wouldn't stop, and I ain't Ice Cube. But I had to take the brother out for being rude. Shot and it's not worth it. Africans need to be loving each other and you're not.
Ken, Happy New Year and welcome back to Fresh Air.
Well, same to you, thanks.
Tell us why Arrested Development is on your 10 best list.
Well, I think it's a really terrific album and one of the very few records this year that kind of crossed a lot of artificial boundaries in pop music. Arrested Development certainly started out as a kind of rap R&B act, but soon crossed over to pop music. And I think it's a really kind of all-inclusive, all-accepting sort of group. I mean, I think that the line in their hit single Tennessee that I thought was the pop lyric of the year was... my children play in the trees my forefathers hung from. Arrested Development, I think, is a group that espouses a kind of philosophy of all-inclusiveness at a time when pop music is so much about divisiveness, and I really like them a lot for that. I like that the cut that we played, People Every Day, kind of inverts the old Sly Stone song, Everyday People, and makes a lot of kind of pop music references and yet updates that music in a way that's very fresh and inviting, I think.
I like the irony of that track, too, because it's about not being the gangster, not being the real tough guy, winning in the end anyways.
That's right.
But that's the kind of irony that I don't think is in a whole lot of rap.
That's right. And, I mean, it's really the most striking debut album of the year, and it comes at a time when, as I say, I think it included a lot of pop music fans from a lot of different areas in a way that the big records of the year, things like Madonna's Erotica or Michael Jackson's Dangerous or the two Bruce Springsteen albums, really failed to unite the pop audience in a way that those acts once had.
A lot of controversy in rap this year, particularly with Ice-T because of his record Cop Killer. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that it's one of the real tragedies of the year in terms of pop music in the sense that Ice-T had this the band Body Count, which was really not a rap group but a kind of thrash metal sort of act, that in June lots of protests were lodged against this particular cut, Cop Killer. And ultimately, Ice-T ended up voluntarily taking the cut off the album, I think for probably perhaps the wrong reasons. I think that in a sense, Ice-T really wants to remain a player in commercial pop music and figured that this was the wisest thing to do. But I think it was a terrible gesture to make. I think it showed that those kinds of protests can succeed. And you know, that I think that the Cop Killer Cut was very much a protest song. Just as I think this other act, this man named Paris from California, who has a new album out as well, was completely closed out of any kind of major label deal. He had been signed to Tommy Boy Records, which is produced, which is distributed by Warner Brothers Records. But once they heard the cut called Bush Killa and another one called Coffee, Donuts, and Death, which is about the revenge murder of a policeman who has raped a young woman, Tommy Boy and Warner Brothers walked away from that deal, paid Paris off, and he had to release the album himself. And, you know, I think that these cuts, as repellent as the actions that they describe are, don't come from nowhere. I don't think that those kinds of feelings and the sentiments expressed in those songs are without any kind of basis in some kind of social and political truth in this country at the moment. And I think it's terrible that those kinds of songs can't be heard by the people who want to hear them.
Do you want to play something by Paris?
Yeah, I'd like to play a section of this cut called Bush Killa.
Now who was able to make war with the beast? It starts with P, trumpet sound when I push the program and set my sight on a serpent man. Swinging a sword of the righteous, make devils drop, and they just can't spite this genocide in the minds of men make. Brothers like me fill up with hate. I smell a skunk in the air, cause your program still ain't fair. So who you wanna blame for the hate that hate made when we let off and pigs get sprayed? Y'all wanna kill off the black man, but I know your master plan. So we'll see who stopped the black gorilla, P-Dog the Bush Killer.
Are you disturbed by any of the sentiments that you hear?
Very much so. I mean, I think it's awful to advocate the killing of the president on one level. On another level, as I say, I think that there's a tremendous amount of rage and anger and resentment within the African-American community in particular that really finds no release in popular arts other than rap at this point on any kind of wide basis. And so I think that kind of the fact that Tommy Boy Records failed to release this Paris album, declined to do so, successfully marginalized Paris. Paris had an album out last year. His debut album sold 250,000 copies. It had a major label distributor. This new album, which he's now had to release himself, is virtually dropped off the charts, and very few people will hear that music. I think that no matter what kind of sentiment is being expressed, that kind of music has a right to be in the marketplace and be purchased by people who would like to hear it. I think it's basically a serious piece of art.
Is Paris on your 10 best list?
It is not. I mean, I certainly don't think that it's music that I would listen to for pleasure. But I think that it exists, that it does offer its audience what it's seeking, a kind of cathartic emotionalism.
Ken Tucker is with us, Fresh Air's rock critic, and he's talking about some music trends of the year, and he's also featuring music from his top 10 list. Let's move to country music. You've been following country music for a long time, and it occurs to me you were really kind of ahead of your generation on this one. It's become something of
either that or
a
premature
trend.
Old man. Yeah. I'm not sure. I mean, I really, as the years go by, I find my musical tastes kind of diverging in two different directions. I'm really, the things I prize most in pop music are kind of strong melodies and lyrics, which I now find almost exclusively to some extent in country music, and rhythm, which I now find almost exclusively in R&B and rap. So I think that these two extremes, in a sense, the way they've been divided in the pop music marketplace, are the things that I'm most interested in. I mean, I could have come up with a top 10 list in either of those areas. I could have drawn up 10 country records that I thought were exceptionally strong. And this year in country, the overwhelming figure is Garth Brooks. In fact, his outreach extends far beyond country music. The year-end issue of Billboard, which totals record sales, has found that Garth Brooks sold more records, his two albums Rope in the Wind and The Chase, than any rock or pop artist in the country. So he's truly the kind of mass artist that a couple of years ago we would have thought Michael Jackson, say, was, or Madonna. He's replaced those figures as that only kind of artist with that kind of mass outreach.
What country record made it to your top 10?
Well, the one that I thought was the most neglected of the year. I was almost surprised that this record by Dennis Robbins called Man with a Plan, in a way, it's a real hardcore country record. It kind of separates people who are attracted by the pop aspects of Garth Brooks, but who don't like that kind of deep, soulful twang in their country music. Dennis Robbins certainly has this. He's had a couple albums out on very small independent labels, but this album, which was released on Giant Records, distributed by Warner Brothers, was his big break, and it didn't happen. And that's really too bad, because it's a really excellent record.
What do you want to play from it?
I'd like to play the title cut, Man with a Plan.
They say that you're untouchable. Every guy in town has made a play for you. Maybe that's true. Well, I don't listen to what they say. I make my own rules anyway, don't you? I think maybe you do. I know Rome wasn't built in a day. I wanna take my time with you anyway. I'm a man with a plan. I got you on my mind. I'll do what it takes. Gonna make you mine. To make you understand, I'm a man with a plan.
It's got that real kind of Merle Haggard, George Jones, real bedrock kind of country appeal. I think country music in general has become the place where lots of perhaps aging rock fans who would like to hear more singer-songwriter kind of music, clear lyrics, clear melodies, have gone to. Billboard also just publicized this study that's been done that says that more college graduates listen to country music than to rock or adult contemporary, which, you know, sort of another myth exploded about country music appealing only to, you know, poorly educated rednecks or something. It's really become a mass music, I think, in the past year or two.
Well, grunge rock arrived commercially in such a big way. There's even a grunge rock boutique in a major New York department store.
Is that right?
Yeah. So did any of the grunge rock make it onto your 10 best?
In a sense, yes. In a sense, no. I mean, those kind of directly related grunge records directly from Seattle, like Nirvana last year was on my top 10. They didn't put out anything except The End of This Year, which was a kind of collection of outtakes and stuff. But stuff like Alice in Chains and Pearl Jam, tremendously popular. And Pearl Jam sold more than 3 million albums. I find, you know, I was trying to figure out why I really didn't like this stuff, why it kind of bored me. And I read a piece in The Village Voice by Robert Christgau where he said in passing, as an aging rock critic, he wanted to point out that grunge rock was really the 90s version of acid rock. that it was all coming around again, that this kind of slow, druggy, depressive, despairing, lacking wit and energy kind of music was now in vogue again. There is one record that's kind of roughly fits into this genre that I do like, however.
Let me stop you and explain. Sure. Ask you to explain what the genre is for our listeners who don't follow this very carefully.
Oh, sure. Well, it's a kind of it's a white hard rock verging on sort of heavy metal, lots of droning, loud guitars, lots of, as I said, kind of despairing, whining, moaning sort of vocals, which, you know, if despair is your cup of tea, and then certainly we all need some of that to bounce our emotions off of, can be quite palatable at times. But to go album length with any kind of, you know, Pearl Jam or Alice in Chains record, you lose me for... the one record, as I say, I did like that I think roughly fits into this genre is a Los Angeles band called Medicine, which is led by Eddie Ruscha Jr., who fans of the art world might know. His father is the painter Ed Ruscha, a very accomplished painter. Anyway, Medicine released its debut album, and the cut I'd like to play is called Defective.
Fresh Air rock critic Ken Tucker is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Fresh Air rock critic Ken Tucker is here with the records he's chosen as the 10 best of the year.
Ken, you've covered, I don't know, about three records so far. We want to make sure that we hear at least a little bit of everything on your top 10 list, so maybe we could just give a brief spin to the remaining records on the top 10 list, and you could tell us a little bit about each one.
Okay, yeah, the top 10 includes Loudon Wainwright III's album, History, which was a really remarkable song cycle in folk music about his relationship with his family, songs about his children, songs about his ex-wives, songs about his father who died fairly recently. I thought it was just a really remarkably unsentimental yet very personal, specific, and moving collection of songs. Here's one of the more lighthearted songs on it, I think, called I'd Rather Be Lonely.
Let's us make a brand new start. Separate and stay apart. I've had enough having and holding. I'd rather be lonely.
I also liked very much the debut album by the group TLC. The album is called Ooh on the TLC Tip. They're a trio that makes this kind of pop funk music that is really very catchy. It's really the kind of pop catchy music that all too rarely comes along these days. The cut I'd like to play is a song called Baby, Baby, Baby. Lindsey Buckingham from Fleetwood Mac, now a solo artist, put out an album this year called Out of the Cradle, which really I thought had a lot of commercial prospects but really failed in the marketplace. But that doesn't mean it wasn't a terrific record. It's one of those kinds of records that Buckingham recorded, you know, in his home studio, multi-tracking everything himself, playing virtually every instrument, doing every vocal himself. And it's rather than be a self-indulgent piece of work, I think it's a really personal, moving piece of work. The cut I'd like to play is Countdown. Another record on my list is Chuckie Booker's Nice and Wild. It's an R&B record that really didn't cross over to pop, but it really deserved to. It had a lot of really nice tight harmonies, crisp, precise rhythms, and I really like the way Chuckie Booker sings in this kind of loopy falsetto voice a lot of the time. I thought it was a better new Jack Swing record than Bobby Brown's release, which got a lot more attention. The cut I'd like to play is called I Get Around.
Oh, 'cause I get around.
Neil Young put out an album this year called Harvest Moon, which harked back to his album Harvest from 2 decades ago. I don't think it's necessarily Neil Young's strongest album, but I think that it's an album that, in fact, at first I didn't even like very much. It had to grow on me because I thought it was kind of wimpy and folky, and But as always with Neil Young, I find that there's a kind of backbone of strength and even cynicism that I find very bracing. The track I'd like to play is called Dreamin' Man.
Another time or place, another civilization. Really make this life feel so complete. I'll always be a dreaming man. I don't have to understand. I know it's all right.
Freddie Johnston had an album out called Can You Fly? I reviewed this album just a couple of days ago here on the show. It's a really terrific pop rock album with, Freddie Johnston is this intense rock and roll nerdy guy who's really comes at you, and just his songs just take you by the throat and just hurtle you along on his point of view. The cut I'd like to play is California Thing.
High off the roof we rise, flying to a hand up in the sky. Bells in the city ring, I'm doing my California thing. It was a lie.
Sort of left field record I've chosen in my top 10 is called The Music of Raymond Scott, Reckless Nights and Turkish Delights. Raymond Scott composed a lot of music in the late 30s, which were really kind of avant-garde, jazz, pop, all kinds of amalgamations of things that he was sort of the Les Paul, Spike Jones of his era, unrecognized as such to a mass audience, until a lot of these compositions of his were taken by Carl Stalling, the arranger for lots of Warner Brothers cartoons, and piped in under Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck cartoons. And that's really the way a lot of people will recognize this music. A lot of Raymond Scott songs have even been put underneath Ren and Stimpy cartoons these days. The cut I'd like to play is called Powerhouse. And the other three collections on my top 10 list, which we heard earlier, are Arrested Development's 3 Years, 5 Months, and 2 Days in the Life of, Dennis Robbins' Man with a Plan, and Medicine's Shot Forth Self-Living.
Well, Ken, great to have you here, and really interesting to listen to your selections for the top 10. Have a real happy new year.
Same to you. Thanks a lot.
Ken Tucker has been with us. He's Fresh Air's rock critic and also writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the year in film. Film critic Stephen Schiff chooses the 10 best films of the year and considers what those films reveal about the state of the movie industry. Also, Maureen Carrigan reflects on the end of the year of the woman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush has hired former U.S. Attorney General Griffin Bell to help get a copy of Mr. Bush's deposition on the Iran-Contra affair. White House officials have said that if they receive a transcript, the president will release all of the notes that he took as the Iran-Contra scandal unraveled in 1986. NPR's John Greenberg has more.
In 1988, Mr. Bush testified under oath before federal investigators. The questioning lasted 5 hours. Now the president wants a copy of what he said. In a written statement released today, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said that the president requested a transcript about 2 weeks ago, and that yesterday, the independent counsel's office said that no copy would be available at this time. Griffin Bell has the job of getting a copy for public release. Bell will also assume responsibility for advising Mr. Bush if the independent counsel's investigation continues after the president leaves office. A spokesman for independent counsel Lawrence Walsh said that his staff will continue to consider the president's request for a copy of his testimony. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
Yugoslav and Serbian officials warned today that use of foreign force to try to end the fighting in Bosnia would jeopardize any chance of reaching a peaceful solution in the former Yugoslav Republic. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reports from Belgrade.
In a letter to Boutros Boutros-Ghali, Yugoslav Federal President Dobrica Čosić said that if the UN Secretary General does not intervene effectively in the next few hours, Belgrade will not bear any responsibility for the ensuing consequences. Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadžić said that if someone helps Muslims kill Serbs, he would not be able to control the situation. And the head of the Yugoslav Federal Army said that his troops are prepared to defend Serbian forces in Bosnia against foreign military intervention. The warnings came as Lord David Owen, one of the Geneva mediators, made a visit to Belgrade in what appears to be a race against time to keep the peace process on track despite increased Western calls for intervention. The visit came 2 days ahead of key negotiations in Geneva between all three Bosnian warring sides. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Belgrade.
On the eve of a visit to the capital of Bosnia by UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali, shelling intensified around Sarajevo. Heavy fighting is also reported in the northern part of the nation, where Serbian forces appear to have captured key Muslim strongholds. In Sarajevo itself, artillery shelling continued throughout the day, both in the center of the city and in the hills outside. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 10 points to close at 3,321.10 on volume of more than 184 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 5-4. This is NPR News. On the eve of a trip to Somalia by President Bush, U.S. forces added to security precautions by seizing weapons. This angers many gunmen, and street violence continues in the nation's capital. At one place across the street from where Mr. Bush is to talk with U.S. troops, some 30 people were evicted. In recent days, military airplanes have dropped thousands of leaflets warning that anyone pointing a weapon at troops will be shot. Mr. Bush will also visit a Red Cross hospital and spend the rest of New Year's Eve on board ship off the coast of Somalia. Meanwhile, efforts continue to secure other parts of Somalia. After much controversy, the Ku Klux Klan has taken down its cross in Cincinnati. A city permit expired today, but a new cross is scheduled to go up tomorrow. Marianne Zelaznik of member station WNKU reports.
The Klansmen sang Onward Christian Soldiers as they took down their cross before dawn this morning, while a half dozen police officers stood by. But tomorrow, a Cincinnati truck driver says he'll put up another cross on Cincinnati's Fountain Square. Raymond Jones says he picketed the Klan cross last week, but decided to counter the message with a cross of his own. He has a permit to display his 6-foot-tall cross for 10 days beginning tomorrow. Jones, who is a Baptist, says he wants to restore respect for the cross because protesters smashed and spat on the Klan's cross. Protesters tore down the Klan's cross 3 times. For National Public Radio, I'm Marianne Zalesnik reporting.
The government says its index of leading economic indicators moved up 0.8% last month for its strongest showing in 10 months. It was the second month in a row that the index had moved up. Prior to that, the index had gone down in 3 of the previous 4 months. The Commerce Department says November's rise was the strongest since a 1.7% gain in January. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I always like 10 best lists. They give you a chance to compare your taste with the critic who's prepared the list, and they help put the year in focus. We asked Fresh Air film critic Stephen Schiff to make out his list of the 10 best movies of the year, and here he is to present it.
Let's start with number 10 to create suspense. The 10th best movie of the year, I thought, was Malcolm X, Spike Lee's long biography and long-awaited biography of Malcolm X. The 9th, I thought, was One False Move, Carl Franklin's hard-hitting independent film. 8, Best Intentions, also long, Billy August's film of Ingmar Bergman's screenplay about his own life. 7, a little film that I just thought was terrific, called Proof, by the Australian director Jocelyn Moorhouse. 6, American Dream, that's Barbara Kopple's actually Oscar-winning documentary, but it wasn't released. It won an Oscar, I believe, in 1990, but it wasn't released until this year. Maybe it was the 1991 Oscar, but it wasn't released until this year to theaters. Number 5, Aladdin, the Walt Disney cartoon. Number 4, Howard's End, Merchant Ivory version of the E.M. Forster novel. Number 3, The Player, Robert Altman's great comeback film. Number 2, The Crying Game, Neil Jordan's wonderful film. And number 1, Unforgiven, Clint Eastwood's wonderful movie, his best movie ever.
Well, that's a really interesting list. And, you know, some of the films on those lists, I think, kind of epitomize certain issues that really came to the fore this year. So let's look at some of the films and some of the issues that tie into them. Why don't we start with One False Move, which was number 9 on your list. And this is an excellent independent film. Do you think that this was a particularly good year for independent films? And are this year's independent films different in any fundamental way from what we're used to seeing?
Yeah, I think this was a banner year for independent films. There's something really special going on that has been building for a long time. Because, you know, it used to be that an independent film, for a long time it seemed to us critics that an independent film was something that came from Sundance and it had a young girl coming of age and there was a lot of hay, you know, around. And this year, they were really individual visions. They were not, because independent film used to come from a single sensibility in a way, and now it comes from all over the map. You have, you know, violent genre films like One False Move and Reservoir Dogs. You had coming-of-age films like Gas Food Lodging, but it was a very good, very fresh look at things. My New Gun, a quirky film just out of nowhere, just out of the sensibility of its maker, Stacey Cochran. Swoon, which dared to examine the Leopold Loeb murders once again. Laws of Gravity, kind of gritty, you know, outer borough movie. The Hours and the Times, which it took as its subject the most peculiar thing, the relationship between John Lennon and Brian Epstein. So, I mean, it was a terrific year for independent film. Not all of them were great, but they all showed a sensibility that could go anywhere.
Number 2 on your list of the 10 best was The Crying Game, written and directed by the Irish director Neil Jordan, who made a couple of films in America and went back to Ireland and England to work again. Are you glad he left Hollywood?
Yeah, I am glad he left Hollywood. And I've talked to him. He's glad he left Hollywood, too, because the movies he made in Hollywood were bad, and this is his best movie ever. I mean, this is really an astonishing, wonderful movie. And this is something apropos of the independent filmmakers that we ought to take a look at. It takes a lot of bravery. It takes a lot of courage to sort of shun Hollywood, to say no, thank you, to the limos and the money and the fame and the easier entree into things like the Academy Awards. But sometimes you have to do it in order to make good movies. It's pretty rare to find a Clint Eastwood who can work sort of independently within the system. Now, all these people who are wonderful independent filmmakers are going to get Hollywood offers. Many of them already have. You see them succumb one by one. A good example this year is Beban Kidron, who made the, you know, sort of amusing trifle Antonia and Jane, that which we saw last year, and said, well, something good might come of this person. So then she goes to Hollywood and she makes Used People, which I just think is dreck. I mean, it's a movie that it's as bad as any movie made this year, and exposes the limitations to her talent. And I think that people who have a vision need not be fed a new vision by Hollywood. We saw a lot of actors, a lot of directors who had done pretty well on their own, kind of come a cropper this year in Hollywood. You know, Stephen Frears, who has managed to kind of maintain an independence, finally went Hollywood this year. He had made Hollywood films before, but they were sort of on his own terms. This year he made one on Hollywood's terms, and it was Hero, and it was just bad, just plain bad. And you see that happening. So it would be very nice to have a kind of system where people can continue to work on their own in their own way. It would be nice to have national cinemas, like a thriving British cinema and even a thriving Irish cinema, which almost seemed to happen this year, to nurture talents like that.
One of the films on your 10 best list, The Player, weighing in at number 3. It was
this, don't you? Yeah.
Yeah, that's a satire about Hollywood, a very funny satire about Hollywood. And that was directed by Robert Altman. It kind of gave Altman a new credibility in Hollywood. Any other films that you feel revived people's careers this year?
Well, let me before I get to that, say something about Robert Altman. Because Altman, has had a funny career, and it was in the doldrums for a long time. He lived in Paris for a while, and made some very interesting movies there. Vincent and Theo is a wonderful movie. But this, of course, was his big comeback film, and it's a great movie, and everyone loved it. And Hollywood kept saying to him, come on home, Bob, all is forgiven. And Bob said, get out of here. I don't need you guys. And it will be very interesting to see if at the Oscars he gets snubbed a bit, because, of course, this is one of the, it's certainly, well, obviously in my book, it's one of the top five, and I would think in anyone's book it should be one of the five nominees for Best Picture at the Oscars. But he has been so kind of back at you, so sort of nose-thumbing towards Hollywood, even since they've said all is forgiven. It'll be interesting to see whether they're willing to keep him in their good graces. As for other people who've come back, I mean, Clint Eastwood, it's the most remarkable example, because people were saying, Clint, I guess it's over. Even the stars with the greatest longevity finally have to go downhill. And Clint came back this year with his masterpiece, Unforgiven, the best film he's made, one of the best Westerns of the last two decades, a film that both comments on the Western, demythologizes it in a way that we're familiar with, and then remythologizes it
so that
it gives you absolutely everything. It's one of his best performances. There are wonderful performances throughout. It has a really solid screenplay by David Webb Peoples. And, man, it's good, and it's great to see Clint Eastwood in that position. Merchant Ivory, who, if you had asked me 5 years ago, I would have said, please, I never want to see another one of their kind of pallid classic adaptations with sort of so-so acting and a literal-minded script. Howard's End is the best film they've made. After the better part of two decades working together, or maybe it's going on three. I think it's going on three.
Fresh Air film critic Stephen Schiff is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the year in film with critic Stephen Schiff. What were the big formulas of the year that everybody was copying, hoping to really cash in on?
Well, there's a new genre that we've all kind of watched creep up on us over the last few years that really kind of reached critical mass this year. And people have come up with various names for it or have not quite identified it as a genre yet. I call it the indoor psycho movie. And this year, it seemed that every month there was a movie like The Hand That Rocks the Cradle or Unlawful Entry or Single White Female. Indoor psycho movies, because the psycho is in your house. You know, you've welcomed him, or one member of your family has welcomed him, and he's, you know, he might be your husband or your wife or your roommate or your nanny or you know, the cop who loves you and who saves you, whatever it might be. These movies have been around a long time. And, I mean, there are sort of classic versions. Rosemary's Baby is one of them. But this year, it just seemed to be everywhere at all times. And the formula got so tired that kind of... that one like Single White Female, where the acting was rather good and the direction was rather deft. Just the fact that 5 minutes into the film you knew everything that was going to happen made it pall a bit. I prefer not to see one for a while, a little moratorium on these movies from hell.
One of the reasons why you knew everything that was going to happen is that you'd seen it already in The Coming Attractions. That's another trend that really reached crisis point this year. Coming Attractions that tell you the whole movie.
It's as though the people who cut together the trailers have become sort of auteurs in their own right. And they get a lot of attention from Hollywood because a trailer really is a very important marketing device. And so it's almost as though they're deciding to re-edit the film on their own. There's a pretty good film, Lorenzo's Oil, that's just opening in New York now and will open wider. And it's as disease of the week films go, it's about as good as it could be. But when you see the trailer, which is kind of very artistic and tells the entire story without a word, you just feel, well, I've seen that. I mean, if you hadn't already seen every Disease of the Week movie you wanted to see, you've sure seen it after the trailer. And yes, Single White Female had a trailer like that. It happens again and again and again.
I remember last year when we were going through your 10 best list, you pointed out that some of the most dramatic, compelling images people watched, images they couldn't tear themselves away from, happened on television, and what people were watching was real life, the war in the Gulf, the coup in the Soviet Union. Do you see that pattern continuing into this year?
Yeah, I really do. I think this is the second year in a row that events have kind of overtaken movies. I mean, the movies did pretty well in terms of ticket sales this year. You had probably the fourth biggest year commercially in history, not accounting for inflation. But still, nothing at the movies. It was sort of as though real life took the place in the culture that the movies had once taken in terms of sort of plot and characters and twists and turns and characters who are both compelling and mysterious. Nothing could beat the election. No movie could beat the election. You know, the emergence of Ross Perot, the disappearance, the reappearance of Ross Perot, the Clinton scandals, his overcoming of the scandals, Bush plummeting in the polls, scraping his way back. You know, I mean, all this stuff was just amazing to watch. And really, you know, no movie could match it for entertainment value and for the kind of the way it brought up issues and made us talk about them. And, you know, on a smaller scale, a good example of how this phenomenon is acting in American life was the sort of Woody Mia scandal. Because, you know, the Woody Allen Mia Farrow scandal was such a big thing in sort of what people talked about and how people kind of gauged their reactions to, you know, the constant battle of the sexes, et cetera, et cetera. But when it was played out on the screen in a movie by Woody Allen called Husbands and Wives, no one went. And that was fascinating to see. I mean, it's fascinating to see really Woody and Mia as a scandal took the place in terms of the culture, in terms of what we view as entertainment that the movie should have taken.
Spike Lee has a knack of making feature films that actually tap into the reality of the moment. Do the Right Thing was really related to what happened in Howard Beach. Jungle Fever, very related to interracial relationships. How do you think Malcolm X succeeded in tapping into what's happening now politically?
Well, you know, this is interesting, Terry. This is another example of the way events overtook movies. Spike Lee's movie Malcolm X didn't succeed in doing that, and it's failing at the box office. And Spike Lee is such a master of PR that he's sort of outdone himself this time. He's been a PR master to a fault, because all the controversy surrounding Malcolm X and all the issues that the making of Malcolm X raised became much more prominent in the culture than the movie itself. So once the movie was finally released, everyone in a way had had enough of Malcolm X. And when it turned out that it was a rather thoughtful kind of, sort of understated, long, discursive movie about Malcolm X that didn't take a kind of incendiary point of view, but took Malcolm X's life in sections and examined each one and left it to the reader, to the viewer to decide, suddenly everyone sort of shrugged and said, well, that's not relevant to the issues at hand. It's a nice biopic, you know, and biopics can be a problem.
Well, while we're speaking of real life versus movies, we should mention the documentary on your 10 best list. That's American Dream, Barbara Kopple's documentary about the labor movement, focusing in on a meatpacking strike. It was a really complicated movie. It wasn't just, you know, pro or con labor. It was really examining the complicated decisions that that labor had to make.
No, that's right. And I think, you know, documentarians will hate me for saying this, but we really see greatness in a documentary when we feel sort of this could be fiction. This is as thrilling as fiction or more so. When the issues brought up and the conflicts brought up have a real innate drama, when the characters are characters and they represent things the way, you know, a great novelist can make a character represent things. All that happened in American Dream without her manipulating anyone, without her falsifying anything. I think it was a magnificent job.
Are there any movies you're especially looking forward to that you know are coming out early next year?
You know, it seems to me there are two movies that sort of come to mind when you say that. One, I don't think it's coming out early, but we got deprived this year of Martin Scorsese's The Age of Innocence, and because it was just moved back till next year. Mm. I am dying to see it.
Yeah.
Another movie that I have seen in rough cut, that is very, very good, is This Boy's Life, directed by the previously unspectacular Michael Caton-Jones, but it's really not a director's movie. It's from the Tobias Wolff kind of autobiography, and it has a wonderful Robert Getchell screenplay, and it is really strong, and it opens April 2nd.
I can't wait to see that because I really love the writing in the book. Well, I'm going to ask you a favor. For our listeners who are planning to go to the movies over this holiday weekend, of what's playing now, what would you most recommend?
The Crying Game.
I'll second that.
Hands down.
Well, Stephen, have a real happy new year.
The same to you, Terry.
And talk to you soon.
Good.
Stephen Schiff is Fresh Air's film critic and critic at large for The New Yorker. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Tonight we'll talk with a German reporter who contributed to this week's Newsweek magazine cover story on rape in Bosnia. She has many firsthand accounts of rape camps in Bosnia. She's talked with women who have escaped. NPR's Eric Weiner tries to figure out if the upturn in the economic figures will complicate President-elect Bill Clinton's planning for the U.S. economy. Andy Bauer is on the Faces of Hope, people from all over the U.S. and all walks of life who've been invited specially to come to Washington for the inaugural proceedings. And Linda Wertheimer will talk with Diana McClellan, a veteran observer of the Washington political scene, her views on the inauguration.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The year of the woman is drawing to a close, and commentator Maureen Carrigan says that, frankly, she was a little bit disappointed. Here's why.
Just in time to end the year of the woman on a conciliatory note, New York's Governor Mario Cuomo has granted clemency to Jean Harris. I know two women who are thrilled. Both my mother and my mother-in-law regard Jean Harris as a heroine. To them, Harris symbolizes all those women whose lives have been wrecked because they love the wrong man. With some reservation, they feel the same way about Amy Fisher. That Amy's a little off, my mother told me over Christmas dinner, but that creep she was with, he's the one who put her up to it. Judging by that tearjerker I watched on NBC Monday night, my mother has lots of company in her reading of Amy as victim. This Sunday night, ABC and CBS are showing their Amy Fisher movies. CBS's is told from Joey's perspective, meaning that Amy will come off looking like a Fatal Attraction-type nymphomaniac. ABC claims its movie will be objective, but believe me, Amy will either be portrayed as a virgin or a vamp, because mass culture, even in this watershed year, still can't figure out any other way to represent women. Virgin or Vamp is the title of a recent book by Helen Benedict that's given me a renewed sense of the stranglehold these two stereotypes have on the popular imagination. Benedict talks specifically about how the press covers sex crimes, like the Central Park jogger case and the William Kennedy Smith trial. She shows how even responsible journalists tend to squeeze a sex crime victim into one of two images, a snow-white virgin or a wanton female who provoked the assailant with her sexuality. Sex crimes, says Benedict, have a unique ability to touch upon the public's deep-seated beliefs about gender roles. Without too much of a stretch, it's easy to see how the virgin or vamp stereotypes continue to define our attitudes toward just about every high-profile woman out there. Take Madonna. She's credited with controlling her own presentation, but she can't seem to come up with any other images besides the two that are already culturally available. Princess Diana was briefly a vamp when the squidgy tapes were leaked. But now that we know about Charles and Camilla, Diana's a restored virgin. And poor ping-ponging Hillary. One minute she's a non-threatening supermom, sharing child-raising tips with Regis and Kathy Lee. The next she's Rasputin, functioning as her husband's unofficial chief of staff, a policy vamp. I think Clinton was right, by the way, when he got angry with women's groups last week for demanding more women in his cabinet. It seems to me that the quota game just reinforces another kind of sexual stereotyping, as though a woman, by her nature, would be automatically good on women's issues. Think of 8 Phyllis Schlafly's in the cabinet, and you can see that ain't so. Besides, it doesn't matter how many women we have in the cabinet if the same paralyzing stereotypes remain in place. But the future's looking brighter. I hear that in 1993, Daryl Hannah will star in a remake of The Attack of the 50-Foot Woman. Now that's a mass culture female image I could really look up to.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Bob Alls. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, for New Year's Eve, a couple of our favorites from the archives. A concert with the new wave polka band Brave Combo, and a lesson on how to make a hip tune sound square. Also, an interview with actor Martin Short. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.